Okay, so very briefly, what WASOC is, it's spelled with a V, but in Pali you pronounce it a W. And it is the celebration of the birth, the enlightenment, and the death of the Buddha. And in Buddhist countries in Asia, it's a huge big deal. People go to a temple and they bring food and they celebrate and they meditate and the monks and nuns are there and it's a big deal. You can see obviously it is not in this country and yeah, maybe things will change, but right now it's not a big deal. And what I wanted to do, I asked Margaret to talk a little bit about what this would mean to her, you know, waking up, what it would mean for all of us. Is waking up the same as it was 2,600 years ago? So I just wanted her to give some of her thoughts and reflections as we enter WASOC.
Thanks, Diane. I don't know that this is going to be so much about waking up as, but it was to be reflections on WASOC. And when I looked it up, on the BBC website, because they always have the best stuff, they said it was a celebration of the Buddha's birth and enlightenment, and, quote, a time to reflect on his teachings and what it means to be Buddhist. So that's sort of more my theme. Takes place every year on the lunar calendar, of course, in the Asian cultures. So it's the first full moon of the ancient lunar month of Vaisakha, and that's celebrated in a number of the Asian religions. Not that it's the Buddha's birthday, but that holiday. It's usually in May or early June, and this year, the exact day of that full moon is May 19th, which is Sunday. Every Buddhist culture has its own traditions surrounding Vaisakha. Diane has described the bathing of the Buddha, which we'll be doing, and I'm sorry to miss the little guy with it.
I'm not one.
Seems very American somehow. but while I was looking at things, I found also that there is right now a United Nations Day of Vaisakha, which is actually a three-day celebration, and they're holding it this year in northern Vietnam. 1,650 international delegates from over 100 countries, 20,000 Buddhist monks, nuns, and followers, a three-day event advocating sustainable development and addressing the global challenges such as environmental pollution and climate change and other issues as well. And, quote, the relationship of the fourth industrial revolution and the Buddha. So it is a big thing, and this is the third time Vietnam has hosted it. When Diane asked me to talk about this, several things sprang to mind at once, and I tried turning this into a smooth talk, but I'm afraid I may instead just tell you the things that came to mind and how I connected the dots, or I'll give you the dots and you get to connect them, if that works as well. When she first mentioned it, and apparently she had come thought of something of the same. The first thought in my head was that there was a prediction. Thich Nhat Hanh has spoken of it, and I understand the Dalai Lama also, that there was to be a Maitreya Buddha, that this is the era of the Maitreya Buddha. And it is, that's the Buddha of love and compassion. And Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama said, it may not be a person. That this time round it may be the community, that is the Sangha. And the Dalai Lama has good political reasons for that as well, so that the Chinese don't select the next Dalai Lama. But I don't mean that cynically, because I think he also probably genuinely believes that Sangha is the source of it. And so that's one of the dots that I was connecting. I've been reading, I read climate change things, peeking at it, going, oh no, not another one. But I read about it quite a bit, and it's not good news. I mean, we all know that. I've been a member of the Climate Sangha for some time, and I took the original Buddhist precept in climate change class, and those are wonderful ways to, in terms of how to be a Buddhist, because the Buddhist precepts and the Buddhist what the Buddhist methodologies, as it were, help you hold this terrible news. You can strive for equanimity, and the don't know mind. We talk about that a lot in the Climate Sangha, and I have to say it's a continual struggle. I mean, I certainly don't have that waking up, and I don't have that level of equanimity. But if Buddhism teaches us to see things as they are and to look things squarely in the face, then that's our task. And I'm not going to pretend I do it well. I just want to be upfront about that. The two other things that I'd read recently is Elizabeth Colbert, who writes a lot about the sixth extinction. And she had written about the biologists, in order to cope with this, often make it very homey. So like the last tortoise of his species was named George, and he died. And one can be fairly sure that he may have had a concept that he wasn't able to mate, but it's doubtful that he said to himself, "And I'm the last one." But apparently some biologists who study snails had the last of a species of snail, and they called him George too, and George just died. And she said, you know, it's a way of making us relate to this, but it's not, and we could make it more personal, but in some ways it also doesn't bring on the real seriousness of this, because, I mean, what's that snail to us? And it's not just that we're what's in it for us kind of species, but everybody tries to survive and to see the relationship is difficult. So then I had shortly after that read an article about there's a glacier somewhere in the world, and of course I no longer remember where, but it has a particular ecological niche. And while it shares some things with all glaciers and with the surrounding countryside, it has a number of species that are just belong to that glacier. And when that glacier melts, it's melting faster than those species can evolve to adapt to it. And so when that glacier is gone, those species are gone. Now, it's not a lot, and they probably doesn't affect human existence. I mean, what's in it for us? But those species are going. And the UN report that just came out, which is also not great reading, I recommend that you Google it just to see the high points, but it's not fun. Let's see. One quarter of the species have gone extinct in the last 50 years or so. Threatened species, 40% of the amphibians, 33% of marine mammals, and 33% of insects. And it's only now sort of coming into human consciousness that those insects are really important. I heard the complaint of an invertebrate biologist that they can never get anything, they can't get funding, because invertebrates, so like crabs, spiders, things. Yeah, he's a spider guy. And they can't get research funding because they aren't the kind of things that human beings can relate to, and even scientists have those kind of biases, right? They'd rather study things that directly relate. And yet those species are the foundation of keeping us going. And anybody who's studied science or even has a general knowledge of it knows that we are part of an ecological web. And some of the things out at that end of the web may not directly affect us, but that the strands of that web are fraying. They're falling apart. We most are touched by the talk of the collapse of the bee communities, because bees, of course, affect agriculture, and that affects our food supply. So we can kind of get behind bees, and besides, they're in our gardens, and they're things that we see. But the point is that we are slowly, as we are using the land in ways that aren't useful, as we are polluting the air in ways that weren't useful, and the oceans, then, I mean, one of the things that shocked me in this report is it says only 7% of marine fish stocks are sustainable right now. the rest are being overfished, or they're dying because the oceans are heating, and we have that the plastics all there, in there. We're encroaching on the wildlands, which are the places that absorb carbon for us, because our most immediate use is for farming or for building cities or for doing all that. So we've had all these policies, and we've thought we had time. And the scientists, I think, also thought we had time. You can read in any of those reports, they say the glaciers are shrinking faster than they thought. The Arctic is melting faster than they thought. It used to irritate me that, as a campaign, polar bears were used. Not that I don't like polar bears, because I really do, but to campaign that polar bears are becoming extinct when the fact is that it's us, and I am all about us, that message was not getting across. I get irritated, no equanimity there, on when the focus is on sea level rise, because which is a serious problem. There's no doubt it's going to wipe out cultures, and it's going to affect people. But the weather is going to affect our food supply, the unpredictability and all that. So you can hear the panic rising in my voice. And part of our discussions in Climate Sangha and in the precept class had to do with right speech, and at the time, mostly about climate deniers. But I find myself, the problem for me is, how do I talk to my family who are not climate deniers? They know that it's happening. They know all these things, and it's scary stuff. And they don't want to talk about it. They really don't, because it's scary. It's all quite scary. So that's where, I mean, Buddhism gives you a container that you can hold all this stuff in, and you can make yourself face it. But one of the other things that we get out of the Sangha and in the class is Joanna Macy had said, and I'll get the quote wrong, but action mitigates anxiety. So taking action is also incredibly important from a Buddhist standpoint. The Buddha early on talked about the interconnectedness of all beings, and we, at the end of all of our metta, say we wish metta towards all beings. That's what, the practice is dedicated to reducing suffering for all beings. And if you're like me, I wasn't thinking of that snail. You know, I was generally thinking of all beings. And even when I studied all this, and I understand from a theoretical point of view the interconnectedness of beings, that's still kind of out there. I mean, I get that, I really do, and I really feel for it. But there was something about when Diane asked me to do this that it struck, that when I simultaneously thought of that prediction that the next Buddha is the Sangha, then I really understood all those beings, that's our Sangha. And every time one of those beings dies, a member of our Sangha has died. And every time one of those species goes extinct, that's our Sangha going. And that, for some reason, galvanizes me to an action in a way that all of the other things. I mean, I have been active. There are still some things where I've been buying time. Right. I call myself mostly meatless. I don't think I could be vegan, Karen, but I think I could push myself to be vegetarian. I think there are. I think the time is now for us all to push ourselves a little bit. In terms of political action, obviously we need better leaders. But again, it may not be. There may not be a leader. It may be the Sangha. And so it's our individual changes, but it's also us having the individual courage to talk to our families who don't want to hear it, even though they know it and they believe it, and it's, yeah. But one more vacation, please. Just one more plane trip. And I think we just simply need to seriously think about all of that, because we're all in it together, and it really isn't very pretty. We have people in the Climate Sangha who have accepted this, and who are pessimistic about the outcome and accept it. Me, I'm too attached. I still am too attached. And the twin things about climate, if you're for the scientists who are active in it, are adaptation, because it's here. I mean, even if we all were totally green right now, what's been set in motion would still be happening. But there's adaptation to that. It becomes predictable. But if we don't stop it, then it's even more unpredictable. And that's the other avenue, is the people who are trying to figure out how to sequester more carbon, extract more carbon, stop it politically, do all that. And I can't speak to any of you as to what it will be for you, but I just found that concept of my Sangha now is literally every little being and every species was personally galvanizing. So that's my reflection.
Thank you, Margaret. I really appreciate it. And so that brings us to awakening and what Margaret had said, Thich Nhat Hanh has, and the Dalai Lama has said, the previous premise, 2,600 years ago, that you wake as an individual is no longer workable. We have to wake as a community. And this is especially difficult for Buddhists because we love our individual meditation practice, and the traditional teaching has been, we wake up as individuals. I think now it is gone where we wake up as individuals and we also wake up as a community, both. Unless we wake up as individuals, we're not going to have the wisdom to move forward. And the wisdom to move forward is to include all living beings. We are the earth. We're not separate. We're not like nature's there and we're here. We're all made up of the four elements. And you take one of those elements away, we all disappear. Every one of us. So it's... we have to start thinking in different terms, and I'm hoping this Vaisak maybe you start thinking in those terms. And what can you do in your own life? At the group that Susan and I are going to be facilitating, we're not going to go into despair and grief and flagellate yourself and you're all awful people and don't fly or anything. What we are going to do, though, is how can we spiritually move forward as a community together? What do we do now? How can we use this practice? The Dalai Lama and Bhikkhu Bodhi have said, and David Loy, whose book we're going to be using, have said, Buddhism is in the prime position to address climate change more than any other discipline, because of the interconnectedness that the Buddha talked about, dependent origination, because of this, that. We're the only ones that actually see that and study that as a main, as one of the main premises of our spiritual tradition. Now we really have to live it, like it means something, and not just something you come once a week to listen to and meditate on, and then that's it. You gotta mean it, so. Anyway, with all of that, we're going to do a little ceremony. Would anybody like, before I do it, like to do the little Vaisak ceremony? Oh, good. Okay, so we have a couple. And a couple people. Mm. Okay, so I'm going to show you how it's done. And then you can just line up here and we'll come around the front. So do is you come up, bow to the Buddha. If you're able to get down to do a prostration, you can, or you just can walk up and bow three times. If you can do a prostration, come down, hands down three times. And the little dipper is over here. This is fragrant water. You consider your intention for yourself, for the world, and you slowly pour it over the Buddha. That's it. Get back up again. Bow. And go back to your seat. Okay? Mm-hmm. So consider what you want for yourself, for the world, what you need to do in your life, what you, you know, where you need to go. And this is an outward statement of that intention. Okay, so go to, you know, line up here and then just come in the front and do that. So then just three times, down, So I'm just going to speak a little bit about awakening the Buddha. Is this on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So Margaret told us a bit about Waysak and what it means. It was interesting. When the Buddha first became enlightened, and remember, he was born under a tree, he became enlightened under a tree, and he died between two trees. You know, our whole tradition is based on being part of nature. In his time, everyone respected the devas and the spirits that lived in all living things, in the grasses, in the trees, in the animals. They were all to be respected and to think of in terms of compassion. Anyway, after he became enlightened, he was completely, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, what is it like to be enlightened? I imagine it feels pretty good. Or maybe, you know, I don't know what it's. I just heard a great definition of enlightenment in the Sikkho Dharma book. And it was by Trungpa Rinpoche. And he said, enlightenment is like being pushed. The bad news is, you're pushed out of an airplane and you don't have a parachute. The good news is there's no ground. I think that's you know, you can kind of get a sense of that self, that grasping, that greeniness, that whatever's going on is gone. You know, you're just with whatever's taking place. So the Buddha must have been in that place when he came out of this trance, and he went back to the world, and he passed a guy he used to know named Upaka. And Upaka saw him, and he said, "You look different. You look, I don't know, what's going on with you?" And the Buddha announced, "Well, I've woken up." And Upaka goes, "Huh, okay, good for you," literally, "good for you," and walks away. And the Buddha was, "Huh, you know, I'm an awakened being, what's this guy doing, you know, saying, well, good for you," and walking away. And that's when he realized, even though he was the embodiment of truth and enlightenment, not everyone's going to see it, and they're not going to be affected by it. It is said only, I don't know if this is true, but only an enlightened person can tell another enlightened person. You know, maybe that's the case. So he decided that he's got to figure another way if he's going to teach, not just show up and everybody goes, "Wow, you know, you're enlightened, I want to be like you." He actually had to start teaching according to the audience that he was speaking to. And the first group that he spoke to were the five ascetics that he practiced with. And they woke up when he spoke about there is no permanent abiding self. And he put it in such a way that they understood it. That falling out of the airplane and there's no ground, that's what that is. If we can kind of imagine that. They got it immediately. And that was in the Anatta Laka Sutta, when he talked about this. And if you look at the self and all the component parts, you take one thing away, you're not a self anymore. Take away your body, you're not a self. Take away your mind, you're not a self. Take away your experiences, you're not a self. All of these things that make you you can easily be dissembled as well. So he tried to speak to people about their own enlightenment and about their own way of waking up and speaking to his audience. The problem with all of this, and this comes from Ajahn Amaro, I've read this book a number of times, The Island. Anybody see this and read it? Yeah, it's got a lot of definitions of Nibbana, a lot of them. And the problem is it only describes what Nibbana isn't. It can't describe what it is. And it's called the way of negation, which makes it very difficult for people who want to achieve enlightenment to even know what is it that you're trying to achieve. If I asked each of you what that means, you're all going to have different ideas of what that means according to your own circumstances. You know, you're having trouble with a spouse or partner. God, it's having a good relationship. You know, somebody else, it's going to be something else. So it's what it isn't rather than what it is. I want to find what Ajahn Suchito talked about this. So this way of negation is the only way it can be talked about, but it makes it very difficult for people who have a goal of waking up to know exactly what are you waking up to. So here's what he says, Ajahn Suchito. Nibbana is often held to be the ultimate goal in Buddhism, and yet it is rather ill-defined. It is considered to be remote, indicative of a superhuman vision that sees the illusory nature of the world and hence is free from grieving about its misfortunes. For many people, this gives Nibbana about as much appeal as an anesthetic, and a difficult-to-obtain one at that. So you can see the problem. And that's why I said in the e-news, it seems like we're more concerned about the path and just staying on the path rather than the goal. And I know for me, that's probably the case because it's something I can do and I'm not quite sure what Nibbana is. And I have faith by just staying on the path, maybe this will lead to an end to suffering because I don't know what it is. Another way of describing Nibbana, everybody knows what dependent origination is, right? Dependent arising. If not this, not that. If this, that. Everything is dependent on something else. It goes back to what Margaret was speaking to. Our whole world is dependent on so many things that we don't even think about, you know, like insects. Some are going extinct and it's going to affect us. Because of this, that. So maybe awakening is a much bigger process than we think. But what all the descriptions of Nibbana have in common is the negation of self. It is seeing through the illusion of an independent being, that you are somehow isolated in the world, and it's just you. That's not true. And when the Buddha talked to the five ascetics and talked about no self, they saw that you're dependent on everything. You're dependent on everything around you to make you you. There's no independent self. You know, as I'm saying the words, it's really hard to understand, but that's the common denominator with all descriptions of Nibbana is that dependency to create you. You know, I've given a lot of talks on conceit, which is just another way, another negation. Conceit is either, you know, thinking you are just the greatest thing in the world or you are the worst thing in the world. It's an obsession with self. And it's suffering. Is there any more suffering than being obsessed with self? Is there anything more that causes greater unhappiness? I can't think of anything. Just think when you're obsessed with self in your life, and it's all about me, and it's all about what's going on with my life, and it's never going to change. That's suffering. And the more we do it, the more we suffer. So in the Bahiya Sutta, But he wanted to know, he demanded the Buddha speak to him and tell him, how do I stop suffering? And the Buddha said, it's so simple. In the seeing, just the seeing. In the hearing, just the hearing. In the touching, just the touching, and so on with all the senses. Not bringing the self in there and creating another story. You know, it's really difficult to describe. Ajahn Chah talks about it, and a wonderful, and I think you would have even liked this this one. It's just kind of sweet and delicious. And Ajahn Chah does not often talk about his own personal, you know, awakening experiences, and this one he does, and it's one of the few I've read about. Actually, no, this is a description of how he sees awakening. When we attain the Dhamma, we know clearly. What do we know? We know there are only conditions and conventions, no self, no us, no them. This is knowledge of the way things are. Seeing in this way, mind transcends things. The body may grow old, get sick and die, but the mind transcends this state. When the mind transcends conditions, it knows the unconditioned. The mind becomes the unconditioned, the state which no longer contains conditioning factors. If this, then that. The mind no longer conditioned by the concerns of the world, conditions no longer contaminate the mind, pleasure and pain no longer affect it. Nothing can affect the mind or change it. If the mind is assured, it has escaped all construction. Seeing the true nature of conditions and the determined, the mind becomes free. The free mind is called unconditioned. That's no self. That's seeing beyond this concept of self. Again, a really hard thing to try to get your mind around. But that's why we also have a meditation practice, because those are the times when you can have those. Anybody here, and I'm sure you all have had momentary times of nibbana. Yeah, I think we all have. Ajahn Chah said if we didn't have those, we might just give up. That, you know, hopefully we do have these momentary times of bliss, of happiness, of seeing through the illusion of the self, and that gives us faith and hope that I can do this. You know, then you get sad because they don't last. But that's not going to last either. It's just sadness because it doesn't last. It's why everybody's encouraged to go on retreat, because on retreats you're more susceptible. Oh God, I wish I could remember how that was put. Nibbana is an accident. Meditation makes us accident prone. And so on a retreat, we're more accident prone. We're not trying so hard. In fact, sometimes, I know for me, when you're on a retreat and you just give up finally, I can't do this. It's beyond me. And then all of a sudden, you get that state of that momentary bliss and happiness, because it's no longer you grasping and wanting. You've given up. At least that's the momentary bliss states I've had, is when I've given up. I can't do this. I'm done. So Margaret talked about the Buddha of the future. You know, we got to start with our individual waking up, but that's no longer enough. And Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. The historical Buddha talked about the Buddha of the future. And we can expect that, quote, person. And Thich Nhat Hanh has said, this is what he said, the Buddha Shakyamuni, our teacher, predicted that the next Buddha would be Maitreya, the Buddha of love. It is possible that the next Buddha will not take the form of an individual. The next Buddha may take the form of a community practicing understanding and loving kindness, a community practicing mindful living, and the practice can be carried out as a group, as a city, and as a nation. I find that inspiring, and when, you know, our group that's meeting tomorrow, this is the kind of tact we're taking. We're not going to go into despair and grief and beating ourselves up, but, you know, how can we affect ourselves and others? Climate crisis, according to David Loy, is a spiritual crisis because we're just not seeing the way things are and how dependent we are on each other. We're ignoring it because of the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. I want what I want. I don't care what happens to anybody else. I want a brand new car. I want a big house. I want this. I want that. I want more than they've got. Greed, hatred, and delusion. We've got to start seeing through that. And we've got to start changing the way we live and the way we treat each other and the way we treat all other living beings in the world and plants and everything else that's living. David Loy calls it engaged enlightenment, waking up together. Bhikkhu Bodhi, all three major traditions are now emphasizing this. Vajrayana with the Dalai Lama saying exactly the same thing, and Zen with Thich Nhat Hanh and Bhikkhu Bodhi in the Theravadan tradition. Bhikkhu Bodhi's made a couple of points. I'm just going to mention a couple of them here. To make a change in the world, we need to make a change in ourselves. And our religious consciousness has to change. We have to look beyond short-term goals of liberation into the larger community of sentient and non-sentient beings. This is liberation in action. Buddhism offers us two complementary perspectives that can guide us in our engagement with the world. These are respectively the wisdom of selflessness and universal compassion. So this is the going further than just waking up for yourself, which is understanding selflessness, but also universal compassion for every other living being. He says here, personal identity has harmful ramifications. Well, we can see that. He said on at least three fronts, in relation to material things, in relation to ourselves, and in relation to other beings. We have to shift our consciousness. Each one of us has to find a calling that speaks to us. Something that speaks to us that we want to do something about, whatever that is, and do it. Julia Butterfly Hill, I think that's what her name is, yeah, who sat in the tree. And she gave a talk. I actually went to one talk. She gave at Spirit Rock. Were you there, Karen? It was about 5 years, 6 years ago. Anyway, she's a really a dynamite speaker, and she's wonderful. And after she gave this talk, a young man came up to her, and he said, God, you know, you're just wonderful. You're so dedicated. You inspire me. And she said, inspire you to do what? That's the difference. Being inspired, but to do what? We're not in a place anymore where we just sit back and say, you know, somebody else fix it. Somebody else change their lifestyle. Somebody else talk to politicians. Somebody else has got to do it. Now we have to do it. And personally, I am finding much hope nowadays because of young people and the Extinction Rebellion that's going on, the Green New Deal, you know, which people are actually debating about, and even though some people are saying it's impractical, we have to keep our standard of living, at least it's being brought up. It's now, climate change has become the number one issue right now in the Democratic, for people running for president. I know at Climate Sangha, last time we met, we didn't even get into it because we got into something else, but we're going to have a political discussion. Which candidate do we endorse? Which one is really promoting climate change and doing something about it? Right now, it's Jay Inslee. Hopefully some others will as well. United Kingdom just declared climate emergency, you know, for the whole country. So things are changing, and I think fairly rapidly as this situation, and especially after the UN report came out, I think that's really kind of kicked a lot of people in the butt. You know, this is serious. So I think we have to consider a new way of awakening, not just for ourselves, but for all sentient beings. So I think that's all I have to say. Anybody have any comments or your own thoughts on that?
I do real hope with what's happening with so many young people, and I have also talked for quite a while with arising and speaking out and leadership of the indigenous communities over the world. My first lesson in independent arising and the first meditation I ever did, I learned from Wallace Black Elk, Lakota shaman, who the word in English is the phrase is all my relations, but he said if you meditate and focus on that more and more deeply, you will understand what really matters.
Yeah.
The world.
Right. That's the bigger awakening.
Yeah. And as he did his teaching on it, which was out of his farm in Napa at the edge of a forest, and here came this beautiful hawk, and it just circled over his head. He spoke for 3 hours. And he would briefly stop and address the hawk, who would dip toward him, and then he would go back to talking to us. But what he said then, and I think about it a lot now as I watch the, you know, this awakening, is he said that shaman and indigenous people all over the world, as they go to do in Lakota traditions, the vision quest, but there are different ways to communication with the sacred, the spirit, whatever, they are all being told, you have to go back and take this into the community, and you have to activate it in the world. And he said, on my last vision quest, I was told that if I didn't do that, all my healing powers would be taken.
I love that. Thank you.
I'm interested in knowing more about what Margaret talked about how a spider affects our environment. You know, how we need spiders and about polar bear, and is there a way to get a printout on these things and the statistics, because it's really informative, and this way I could know more, and then I could pass it on to other people.
There was a summary. I'll find it, Ginger, and print it off for you. I'll make a note of that you'd like to have that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Back there. All right. Anybody else have anything to add or say?
I remember that being told that Steve Armstrong has used enlightenment as a verb. Saying that you have these moments, and that at least it gives you something to point, an experience that you can sort of point your mind and heart to, but you can't force it because it will come whenever it comes. But I do struggle with the concept of enlightenment, and there, I've been thinking of it a lot, that there's a part of me that doesn't want that. You know, I am attached to the world, and I'm afraid of, there's a part of me that's afraid of letting go of all that I love. Mm-hmm. And even though if I get pushed down that plane, there's no ground. And in those moments, you're at peace with, It's in the Christian tradition, the peace that passes understanding. It simply is, and it's peaceful. And yet, I have this fear of heading that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a struggle. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And I was also thinking as you were talking about or reading, thinking about the mind. You know, that everything else falls away and your mind. But isn't that still another attachment? Isn't it your mind? Or is he talking about a mind? Is it a global mind? Is it a?
Well, that was an enlightened being talking, and I don't know, because, you know, you can interpret it so many different ways, and I don't know. He just talks about the unconditioned mind, and when the self falls away, whatever that means. Yeah. Again, talking in negation, it's really difficult to understand. All right, I'm just going to then finish up. It is 9:00. Okay, and this is from David Lloyd. The way of understanding Buddhist type enlightenment as the next step in human evolution also gives us a different perspective on the ecological crisis. Of course, our collective sense of separation from the Earth has led to trashing the planet. How could it not, when the Earth is valued only as a means to satisfy our self-centered goals? The eco-crisis is a spiritual challenge as much as a technological and economic one because it prompts us to take that next step. Thich Nhat Hanh's claim that we need a collective enlightenment to stop the course of destruction points to the fact that we now need to evolve spiritually in order to survive physically. Okay. So with that, thank you all for coming. And you brave souls doing the Waisak ceremony. Every year this is what happens. And I really appreciate that you were here to do that. Thank you.